Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 26th of May. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
Bank holiday weekend, a long one. Summer is officially over in the UK. So I've had to come to the Seychelles to top up on the vitamin D, Kev.
I tell you what, I don't need any more vitamin D after the
after the heat wave you've got. You're going to have a bit of a shock to the system, I think, when you come over to the UK at the end of the month. I mean, it's been, I think we had 2 weeks. So
that's a nice breeze today. The temperature's going down to 30 degrees or 31 degrees today, so it should be nice.
Yeah. So what are you coming over for at the end of the month?
Yeah, I'm over just for one thing, which is a presentation in the city for Colin Bird and his companies, basically. So it's sort of a copper special that we're holding in the city of London. So I'll give you some more feedback on that next week.
Sounds very good. Okay, well, let's have a look at some of the news stories that have dominated the headlines this week. The big news talking point, obviously, you actually pinged me this when I landed, and I can't say I was surprised, but Sunak announces early general election amid criticism. Yeah, the news that Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has announced that the next general election will take place on the 4th of July, cutting short the usual timeframe. Sunak cited the need to navigate the country through current global challenges, positioning the election as critical due to dangerous times. In a speech from Downing Street, Sunak highlighted his government's efforts over the past 5 years, defending his record against Labour's criticism. Labour leader Keir Starmer responded by emphasising Labour's plans to return Britain to the service of working people. Sunak's announcement faced backlash from some Conservative MPs who expressed confusion and anger over the decision, especially given the party's trailing position in the polls. There are concerns about key pledges on the economy and immigration, with speculation that Sunak's move is a gamble. So what do you think? Obviously, a lot of this comes after the announcement that inflation rates dropped to a 2.3%, which is their lowest in nearly 3 years. Do you think that this is a kind of announcement that is based on the fact that, yeah, we're doing it, we've contained the inflation rates, we've hit one of those pledges? Do you think this comes at a good time?
I think he's just taking a gamble that, you know, people might be thinking, well, do we want to hand this over just as it's changing to somebody else? Yeah, I think the Labour Party has said, we want change, we want change, we want change. And that's what we're going to hear, I think, for 6 weeks now. And I think it's gonna come, personally. I don't know to what extent, but it seems to be that's the way the public is looking at things. But yeah, let the ballot box decide.
You know, what are the chances of them retaining power? I mean, you know, looking at the polls that I've seen, it looks like pretty much we're going to be looking at a landslide Labour victory.
Yeah, I don't really know, but I think it's sort of less than 1 or 2%, isn't it, that there's a chance that they're going to get back in. You never know in these campaigns, somebody can say something or do something and it changes, but it's looking very unlikely, isn't it? Looking very unlikely.
And there's a lot of laws and pledges that are going to be put on the back burner now. Probably it'll affect the vape bans and the cigarette bans that we've heard Rishi talk about so much. And also the one, you know, remember Martin's law, that security risk management that we've talked to Kerry about, saying that could potentially be jeopardised now with, you know, if Conservative government term is removed.
I know there was talk there that the tobacco vape law wasn't going to be put into effect. So the question is it likely to be in the same format for the Labour government or different? I think it's almost certain that it's going to be extremely different than it is, and maybe not even happen at all, because I think it's hardly going to be a priority for the Labour government when they come in with so many other things they want to deal with. So we will see. We will see. More uncertainty, unfortunately. That's the only thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's move on to our first guest this week.
So we welcome Jonathan Owen from Metals One, and they've just recently had a raise on the UK market, which in this particular time, they've managed to raise £895,000, I think it was. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that, Jonathan, how that came about, and I suppose what's its purpose in terms of you moving this project forward for Metals One?
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. So this is, as you pointed out, you know, it's a tricky market to raise money in, and we're very pleased to have succeeded and, in fact, raised more than we we set out to originally. So the whole purpose of the raise was to effectively take back control of the Black Schist project. As you know, we had an agreed farming arrangement with Gunsynd. This raise allowed us to basically replace that source of funding at the PLC level and bring back ownership at the project level. So why do we do it now? Well, if we rewind back to the strategy update from February for the Black Schist projects, we've got quite an ambitious timescale development plan to bring this asset into production by 2029, 2030. So this is to meet the EU's benchmarks for the domestic supply of these strategic minerals that we have to offer. So the nickel, the cobalt, the copper, the zinc, etc. And that's, of course, driven by, you know, a volatile world and some supply chains and politics. A lot of these minerals are sourced from places like Russia, China, Indonesia, New Caledonia. We saw rioting New Caledonia last week that drove the nickel price to, you know, to recent highs. So there aren't many options really to provide these domestic sources, and we're one of them. So, you know, we see a lot of potential here. We've got fair winds following seas, and, you know, we took the opportunity to do this now as we get going.
Very good. So just give people an overview of Metals One. Anyone who doesn't know Metals One, give us 2 or 3 minutes of how it came about. You came to market last July, I think it was. Since then, yeah, share price has just gone south, basically, on the basis that I think most people don't understand what it is you've got, how big it is, and the potential. I mean, from when we spoke the last time, you've got the potential here of a mine that will last probably longer than my lifetime. And yeah, let's give us your 2-3 minutes.
Yeah, no, thank you. So as you said, we listed in July last year. It was a very difficult market. We were one of only 4 companies to list on AIM last year. So that was a pat on the back, but in a challenging market. And I think then with the nickel price being quite volatile as well, in the meantime, we are effectively a nickel play. That's our primary commodity. Then, you know, we've suffered a little with that as well. But the longer term, medium to long term prognosis for nickel and other strategic minerals, as I mentioned, is strong. And it's due to this drive to support the digital transition, the green transition, and the drive for domestic security of supply. And that's the whole purpose, the whole reason for Metals One's being, is to identify and develop these types of assets. So we've been very active with the Finnish projects, the Black Schist projects. We drilled the assets back in December. We already sit on 28 million ton resource, which is, you know, $8 billion dollars worth of in situ metals. We're looking to at least double that this year.
That was billion, not million.
Oh, that's billion. That's with a B. Yeah, it's a huge resource, and yeah, it's full on. But it's in an unknown mineralization that people don't generally, you know, haven't come across before. It is proven as a source of these metals. We have Talvivaara, which is Europe's largest nickel producer. This is what they mine. They mine it at one of the lowest costs in the world. So they're generating free cash flow. They're generating 25-30% EBITs when nickel is on the, you know, at the bottom of the cycle. And they're also doing this at the lowest carbon intensity globally. So at least 10 times less than the carbon intensity of Indonesian nickel, for example, or Chinese nickel. So it just ticks all those boxes. And for that reason, it's also significantly de-risked technically and economically for us as well. We just have to keep telling the story as we're doing now, Kevin.
Yeah, explain why. I mean, I think a lot of the Chinese and Indonesian nickel is sort of called dirty nickel. Why is it so dirty? What do they have to do as opposed to what you do?
So
or
it's,
will do?
Well, I'm not a chemist, but it's a complex chemistry that requires a great deal of processing. So high atmospheric processing. So they leach these minerals under pressure in large tanks, for example, highly energy intensive. And that energy is generated typically by Chinese built coal-fired power stations. So just bear in mind that most of these Indonesian mining operations, the nickel, owned and operated by Chinese entities, and that they're powered by Chinese power. So there's an inherent carbon footprint that comes with that. In contrast, then you look at the black schists that we have, and that's Talvivaara mining already. These much simpler chemistries, they're much easier to extract the metals. We use bio-heap leaching, so you basically lay the ore out on the ground. You percolate bugs and bugs through this pad of ore, and the liquid that comes out, then you basically precipitate out the the nickel sulfate that you sell then directly into the battery supply chain. So there's no refineries, there's no smelting, and the recoveries are really good. The yields are excellent. So you can recover almost 95, 98% of the nickel that's in that ore. Compared to other types of nickel ores, you'd be happy if you recovered 75%. So all these things feed into an opportunity to be, like I say, lowest carbon intensity producer at the lowest cost. So you're going to be last man surviving through a commodity cycle, and you'll be generating free cash flow throughout. So hence the opportunity and hence the placing.
Yeah. So historically, what information is available, what resource is already defined in terms of what you have there in Finland, is it?
Yeah. So we acquired a 28 million ton resource. So this is categorized as an inferred resource from Blue Jay Mining, previous owner. We also acquired a number of other targets, including what we call P5. This is has a lower classification. It's an exploration target, in quotes, and that at the moment is our focus for the next few months, is to develop the P5 asset. What's exciting about this is that should be an inferred resource. It should be 20 to 30 million ton resource. The reason it's just a lower categorization is basically because the previous owners didn't complete the assay work. They drilled the 5,000 meters, spent $3 million on that, and basically dropped down tools. They went off to Greenland to chase an opportunity in Greenland. And this is back until the early 2010s, 2012. So the opportunity that we saw really was to come in, complete the assay work on that 5,000 meters of drilling, remodel the P5 asset, and then hopefully upgrade that to an inferred resource. So what we could potentially be doing now over the next couple of months is going from our base of 28 million tons, which, as you pointed out, it's billions of dollars worth of in-situ metal, and potentially doubling that over the next couple of months. So how do we do that? So the assays have been completed. So we announced yesterday the receipt of all the assays from the labs in Ireland. Those assays now will be updated into the model. And then we've commissioned Mining Plus, a global mining service provider, to undertake that mineral resource estimate. So as an independent company. So we expect to have that then, that the mineral resource estimate in July, and there you'll have it. We'll go from 28 million tons inferred resource to hopefully 50 plus inferred resource, if not better.
What, if any, have you got any comparison companies that would have even the 28 million resource, whether they be on the UK market, whether they be on the Canadian market or the Australian market? What, have we got any comparisons of where people can grasp onto, well, Metals One should be in this ballpark bracket in terms of its valuation?
I definitely. There are plenty of peers, particularly on TSX and ASX, so nickel developers, if you like, in North America and Australia focused. And so they've got similar tons to us. So you've got Talon Metals, Premium, and Nickel, Magna Mining, Wyloo Metals, etc. And they've got, if you strip out their other assets, they've got enterprise values, orders of magnitudes greater than ours. If you look at Talon Metals, they've got slightly more tons of nickel equivalent tons in the ground than us, but we'll soon catch up with them, as I say, in the next month or so. And they're sitting with a market cap of 92 million pounds. That's converted from Canadian dollars, of course. We're sitting at, where about three at the moment.
Okay, so they've got 92 million pounds and you've got 3 million pounds?
No. Exactly. So,
and they're obviously further forward. They must be mining or something. If that's
they're not. They're at exactly the same stage as us, if not slightly earlier than us. So we're moving.
That seems ridiculous. Why?
It is. Yeah, it's our job to close that gap.
Okay, not even close the gap. Maybe with nickel rising, their valuation probably isn't super high either, really, ultimately.
Yeah, I can't comment on the TSX markets and how the perceptions and over there, but definitely here we have an opportunity. Even if we triple, quadruple, we'd be extremely happy. If we could, what is 92? But 30 times uplift would be spectacular. But that would bring us in parity with our peers.
Yeah. Okay. So the way forward then on the schist, is this is a well known place to know. You talked about another nickel producer now, but how long have people been developing this area? How long's mining been going on?
That's a perfectly timed question, because I was just reading now this morning the release of the Fraser Institute report on mining investment. This is an annual report that looks at mining jurisdictions across the world and ranks them by attractiveness in terms of investment jurisdictions. And Finland, again, comes out you know, as one of the top, certainly top in Europe. And that's because they've got that, as you say, the heritage of mining. They understand mining. They've got the skills. They've got the legal framework set out very clearly. You know, it's a stable framework as well. So you know exactly what to expect, so what to plan for, what to budget for, and also timelines as well, which is important. Because, you know, when you're throwing around NPVs for projects, delays in permitting, of course, can massively throw that out the window. So we've got a high confidence level in that as well. So, yeah, a lot of mining in the area. The communities, and this is obviously huge, as everyone knows, hugely important to the success of mining and mining development projects is the social license to operate. If you don't have it, you know, you can have the best asset in the world, it's not going to move forward. And we've seen that in the US with Resolution Copper, for example. You know, they've sat on permitting for 20 years. Here, we don't have that. We have, the opposite. We have the EU Critical Raw Materials Act, which is just adopted a couple of weeks ago, which is bringing in the fast tracking of projects like ours, so strategic projects with strategic minerals, to get these mines built, developed, ramped up, commissioned, and in production by 2030.
And in terms of Europe, what are those critical metals? We've got nickel. What else?
There's 34 of the critical materials.
That's a big question.
There's 34 critical, but then you have a subset which is strategic, and it's the strategic ones that then get not only the fast tracking, but also opens up the opportunity for EU-backed project financing. For example, from the EU Battery Fund that's just been set up, it's a 500 million euro fund to support projects like ours. So what you have on there is you have nickel, copper, cobalt, lithium, and there's some rare earth metals on there as well. I'm not sure if graphite's on there, but we're certainly...
These are the strategic ones.
Yeah, these are the ones.
In the same way as there is some issues with, or not issues, there is grants being given in the US... one of the companies we deal with, the Golden Metal Resources, they've got a tungsten in there. They've applied for a grant in the US as well. So you anticipate that in Europe, this could be the same thing. And Metals
Correct.
One will
what,
be
what, yeah,
will what, be applying for this then? Or
absolutely. Absolutely. So how does it work? So the criteria, three of the four criteria, I mean, the criteria being, of course, you're looking at strategic minerals, you're looking at getting into production by 2030, etc. And then the other one is then you need to have at least a preliminary economic assessment for the project. So, you know, you have an idea, you know, in rough terms, what the NPV capex internal rate return is going to be like in the, you know, the timeline. So, you know, a rough engineering plan and economic plans to develop the mine. Once we have that, then we can go into the application process with the EU to be recognized as a strategic project. And that then also opens up access to the funds, so such as the EU Battery Fund. And they're willing to come in and fund on an equity basis companies up to 20% for a listed company. So it opens up all those doors for us. So we just need to get there. And how do we get there? We're going to get there quite quickly. We're going to get there this year, we believe. So we've got the resource estimate now being updated, as I mentioned, on the back of the assays being received. We'll have that in July. That will underpin then a preliminary economic assessment, which we'll commission in July or thereafter, and with the hope of having that completed by Q4, so October, November this year. That then we take to the EU, and then they can it becomes more tangible to them as a serious contributor to this benchmark that they have.
So I sense, Jonathan, how frustrated are you from a 1 to 10 about how badly this market is understanding your situation?
It is frustrating. You can blame the market, you know, in its ethereal sense of what exactly is the market out there. But you can look to yourselves and just do what you can to share the message and couch it in terms that people understand and resonate, and it resonates with. And that's, you know, conversations like these, Kevin, you know, help greatly with that.
Yeah, no, it seems to me a very simple situation. We've only really talked about nickel. Now, one of the things that people are shouting from the rooftops at the minute is the copper. How much copper is involved in your processing? Is there a small amount of copper as you bring up the nickel as well? What's the magnitude?
Yeah, so it's about 2-to-1 ratio. So for every two tons of nickel in the ground, there'll be a ton of copper in the ground. So that's the ratio. The recoveries on the copper, so nickel, we can look to up to 98% recovery of the metal out of the ground once through the process. Copper's probably a little lower, so we're at about 80. So but he's still in the, you know, it's still a major contribution, and it's a second, you know, true secondary mineral in our business plan. So.
Yeah, well, when you're talking about 2-for-1, you're adding another $5,000 to the price of your nickel if you've also got a cash copper.
I mean,
as well. So you would be looking at nickel at $26,000 if you have the copper there as well, which would be pretty phenomenal.
That's right. That's right. And people maybe don't realize that nickel is at least ton for ton twice the value of copper. The focus at the moment is on copper. But you know, if you look at your cost of production per ton, nickel's where you want to be. So still, the other focus is, we call ourselves a nickel play. Definitely, copper is up there as well.
Yeah, you're definitely a nickel copper play if it's 2-for-1 for sure. And I presume there's very little extra cost for realizing the copper when you've already dug up the nickel.
No, correct. It all comes out to use the pine in the wash through the leaching process. So it all comes, including the copper and the zinc as well, which are other, you know, quite significant contributions to the to the economics. So
And the other thing I was doing the research, and maybe I'm just sort of asking you an overall comment. When I looked at the forward advance prices for nickel, you know, we were looking December 25, December 26, December 27, you know, bid and offers, and basically they're on the up. In other words, so, you know, we're talking 21.7 December 25, 22.3 December 26, and 23,000 roughly by December 27. So, you know, as this comes into production, we're looking at contracts with LME that are actually increasing. Now, we could actually have increased further. We're about 3-4% higher than we were 12 months ago in terms of LME prices, even though we've had an absolute cavernous drop and then back up again. But the long-term view of nickel has to be that, is it the same as copper? There's not enough in production. I mean, nickel is pretty prevalent in the world, but the problem is getting it out of the ground.
It is getting out of the ground safely, cheaply, and minimum carbon intensity, and that's the challenge that Indonesia has. You know, it's while they have they're churning nickel out, it's not sustainable. I don't think from a social perspective, you know, villagers, fishermen being displaced and losing their land being bulldozed into the sea, etc. It's pretty bleak, and something's going to happen there that's going to curtail that source. But no, you're right. It is exactly this observation that drove the founding of Metals One. It was actually at the back of the EU's Roskill report, which was sanctioned a few years ago by the EU to look at the nickel market and the battery metal space. And what it came up with was a quite stark conclusion that there is a structural deficit in the supply demand of battery metals into Europe. And it was just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's what we're starting to see, is a significant demand supply balance. You overlay that then with the sustainability questions of sourcing these minerals from, you know, China, Russia, Indonesia, etc. And it's not just the carbon intensity of these sources, it's also the supply chain risk. We saw with COVID, you know, the effects that disruption had on the supply of any, you know, all sorts of toilet rolls, oil, etc., on shipping lanes. And then we have the sovereign risk, the political risk of these countries, the social risks of uprisings in New Caledonia. We might see the same in Indonesia. They continue to put mining first and communities second. So It's all pushing nickel price up, and it's pushing it our way. Clean, low cost, local support, you know, for local sources of these minerals.
Yeah, very good. Well, Jonathan, it's been really good catching up with you. We're basically looking at, for anybody who's interested, it's Metals One, MET1, and we're talking about nickel and copper, in terms of productivity, and it's in Finland. So, any last words, Jonathan, that you'd like to say to people why they should be sticking you on their watch list, or maybe even pressing that buy button?
Press the buy button, please. Bang that bell. So exactly, this is exactly what we've covered, Kevin. It's you know, this is the right time to produce the right metals for the right market. You know, we're looking at supporting the green transition, the digital transition, with clean battery metals, locally sourced. Now, we've got fair winds with the legislation and potential financing options to get these projects generating free cash flow very quickly. And we're kicking goals day by day to get to that point. And we expect, you know, a severely undervalued share price at the moment to step into the realm of our peers in the not too distant future.
Yeah, 300 million shares an issue. pretty tightly held from the discussion we had last time. And
most of it's locked up. Yeah. So it really starts off.
£3 million market capitalization with a 1p share price seems absolutely ludicrous for what you've actually just told us. So yeah, we wish you luck and we look forward to speaking to you over the coming months as well. Once these assays come in and you're in a situation where hopefully the resource has increased drastically and then you move forward towards a grant, it would be a pretty simple story.
I think so.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, let's move on to our second guest this week. We're joined by Sapan Ngai, CCO of Sovereign Metals. Welcome back, Sapan.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
Absolutely. So we just saw the news that the company is launching a pilot mining and land rehabilitation program, the Kasia Rutile Graphite Project in Malawi. This program is essential for determining optimal excavation, backfill and land rehabilitation methods, will also support the upcoming definitive feasibility study by providing crucial data. With all necessary approvals from Malawian authorities secured, the pilot will occur over 3 months on a 9.9-hectare site, featuring a 20-metre-deep test pit and various rehabilitation tests. The project aims to demonstrate land rehabilitation to local communities and enhance Sovereign's processing capabilities in Malawi, contributing to the sustainable development of the world's largest natural rutile and a significant natural graphite deposit. The preliminary feasibility study, PFS, underscored Kasia's potential, projecting the post-tax NPVA of $1.6 billion with significant annual revenues and EBITDA, affirming status as a major player in the global minerals market. So tell us more behind the rationale for this pilot mining program, please, Sapan.
Yeah, so look, any big, large-scale, tier-one type deposit, you can't develop, construct, operate these huge world-scale mines without actually doing some type of pilot test work. And that's the phase that, you know, Sovereign's entered into as of today. So we continue with what we call the optimization, which is basically taking the PFS that Sovereign did standalone and applying a number of techniques and ideas that our strategic partner Rio Tinto has on top of that, as well as what, you know, our new built out owners team have as what may be the optimal ways of mining, of backfilling, of rehabilitation, of processing this ore. So really, look, the objectives of the pilot phase are this. We'll optimize mining methods. So we're actually mining out about 150,000 bench cubic meters of ore. That's within an area which are ore reserves under the JORC code. We're only going down to about 20 meters. As I've said before, we're not looking to hard rock mine anything, right? And at around 20 meters, it starts becoming hard rock. We're interested in the really soft stuff, the really easily diggable, hydro-mineable material, you know, essentially the soils that sit from surface down to that 20 meters. And they encapsulate all the mineralization and all the resource that we talk about. So we'll be mining that using combinations and permutations of hydro and dry mining to best see what fits. We'll be processing that ore. And that includes a scale-up of processing capabilities in Malawi. You've probably seen an RNS about a month or so ago that we had procured a spiral concentrator. So that's being tested at a lab in Cape Town. That'll make its way up to site, and we'll be using that. The processed pre-concentrate or concentrate that we get out of there, it's all ending up with potential customers, end users, off-takers, ending up in labs, so we know exactly what our product will be, you know, what are the goods that we will be selling as Sovereign Metals once we're up and running. Importantly, we'll be doing a lot of rehabilitation of the land to best understand how we restore the soils to how they were, if not better. And we'll be better understanding some of the tailings management. You know, we're taking out 100% of this ore. Out of that 100%, about 1% is rutile, about 1.5% is graphite. So the other, what's remaining, that 97.5% of the stuff, how does it best fit when we put it back in the pits or decide to store it as tailings? And what's the best solution for doing that as well? That's essentially the pilot phase in a nutshell. It's going to last around 6 months, at least for the mining phase. And in terms of the rehabilitation, I mean, that's an ongoing thing that will clearly continue through the advancement of Kasia.
Yeah. Just while we're on that, because you obviously touched on the previous RNS, sort of middle of May, just talk us through those results. I think you did some downstream test work that you sent off to, was it ProGraphite GmbH, so an independent consultant. Just talk us through those results and really what they mean, because probably a lot of people reading these RNSs don't really understand this spherical purified graphite and how important it is, really.
Yeah, so let's talk about how graphite ends up in your electric vehicle, right? So you dig it up in an ore, you concentrate it. That basically means you turn it into 90-something percent graphite. That 90-something percent goes to what's known as the first downstream ore, where it's ferronized, which is basically those flakes. So imagine like cornflakes of graphite are turned into small balls. Those are purified because you want to get rid of all the impurities that won't make the graphite work well within a battery. And then those balls are then coated in material that sets them ready to be put into the anode end of any lithium ion battery. So what we've announced over the last few weeks is, number one, taking our 1.4% graphite in the ore, once you concentrate it, it can become 97% graphite concentrate very quickly with no acids or leaching or any kind of, the usual types of ways that we concentrate. It's really simple mechanical flotation and cleaning of the graphite. That 97% graphite, now the tests so far show it can be spheronized, it can turn into those small balls, and it can be purified. But importantly, it can be purified to 99.99% with any impurities within that 0.01%, and specifically impurities like sulfur being so low that they surpass the current standards of graphite required for batteries. The next stage, and what we'll be coming out with over the course of the coming weeks, are results that we await on, well, once we coat those small balls of graphite, what do they do in terms of being charged up in a battery? And what do they do in terms of the charge and recharge of the batteries several times, thousands of times? And so what does Cassia's graphite ultimately do in a battery? And that's information that, we hope to get from the labs in the coming weeks.
Yeah. So basically, is that effectively demonstrating that Cassia has that potential to deliver, or disrupt potentially the Chinese dominated graphite supply chain as that secure source of the high quality graphite?
That's absolutely the strategy. Last week, the Biden administration slapped a 25% tariff on all Chinese graphite, just showing the importance of, ensuring that there's a security of supply of things like graphite outside of China. China dominates the market. Let's make no qualms about it. If you're driving a Tesla today, most likely your electric vehicle components were at least the battery components were made in China, or at least processed in China. What we've got with Cassia is a long life, a significant producer at low cost of this graphite concentrate that someone else can turn into the battery material and then get it into electric vehicles and lithium ion batteries going forwards.
So, Shapan, the question on my sort of, or that comes to my mind is, you're supposed to be doing a DFS. You're probably going to find out a lot more information from actually digging the stuff up than a DFS. Is that fair to say, or am I undermining what DFS will do?
Totally fair to say. Look, what we see time and again, DFSs, PFSs, once they're done on a project and they go very quickly into construction and into production, the operations seldom look like what was written on a piece of paper on, the front page of a DFS highlights section. And sometimes the case is because nobody thought about actually digging the stuff up, processing it, deciding on, things like tailings management, rehabilitation, way before, and even permitting, right? We got this thing permitted by the Malawian authorities within 3 months. All these steps, we're basically doing what we intend to do for 25 years, at least, for the course of the coming 6 months, is essentially the way I see it. And what it means is all that empirical data we get, it's going to be worth way more than any desktop analysis or any spreadsheets could tell us. It's also you know, exactly what our strategic investor Rio Tinto is looking for in terms of the empirical data. It's what owner's team now, you know, we've got so many individuals that have done this time and again and built some of the biggest mining projects around Africa. And we're all pulling in the same direction, which is let's get this pilot phase up and running and let's get the data, because that will give us, as I said, tons more information than anything we could do in front of a computer screen.
So what are you going to do with this production then? Obviously, you are going to produce some stuff. It's probably not going to be a huge amount in terms of any financial situation, but what's going to happen with it?
Yeah, look, we're not looking to sell this product that's going to come out. It will be used in test work. It will be used in labs. It'll define exactly what our products will be once we're up and running. You know, what it's all well and good being the largest producer of rutile, but exactly what does our rutile look like versus any other rutile in the world? I'm pretty confident it's you know, having done a lot of this lab scale work before, that it's premium quality. And on the graphite side, you know, what does our graphite absolutely look at, and importantly can we continuously process the ore into these commodities? You know, it's all well and good doing a bit of digging, a bit of processing, a bit of test work, which is essentially what, you know, companies at our stage tend to do, but to continuously do it is another matter. You know, then you've got to start thinking about the logistics, the power, the water, the tailings management, all of that good stuff, which is, yeah, we'll learn all those lessons in the next 6 months.
Yeah, and how is, I remember you were raving about this other guy that you'd appointed who was a world expert in graphite. How's this process going to help him to help you guys?
Well, look, so one of the key things, so Surinder Garg, who joined us as a CTO about a few months ago, you've probably already seen, you know, we've thrown out a fair few RNSs on the graphite side, and that's all the IP that he's basically put in for us, IP in inverted commas. He basically told us from the start how graphite acts in a lithium-ion battery depends on how it's mined and the process from the point that it comes out the earth to the point where it ends up in a battery. And what we'll be doing as this pilot phase is essentially understanding what the optimal methods of extracting the graphite before, you know, we'd end up shipping it to anode producers, battery makers. You know, what are those optimal ways of doing the extraction part and the processing part and the concentration part?
And I mean, from the point of view of you mentioned the shareholder as in the 15% Rio Tinto. So what's the sort of take on all of this? What are they going to be doing to add? I think you're saying there were some technical people for you to help.
Yeah, look, firstly, this is all well within our budget that we've decided on. And you know, clearly we have Rio Tinto involved in some of the budgeting processes. Secondly, the whole pilot phase was developed by the technical committee. Technical committee is 50% Sovereign, 50% Rio Tinto. So they're fully aware, they're fully engaged on this pilot phase.
And just remind people, what's Rio Tinto's option to buy further shares in Sovereign Metals?
Yeah, so Rio Tinto came in July, mid-July last year. They invested 40 million Australian dollars at 48 cents to get 15% of the company back then. They have an option to increase that 15% to 19.99%. That option is at 53.5 cents, which is around 29p there or thereabouts on the AIM line. And that option expires mid-July, so 1 year since their initial investment. So we wait to see what Rio Tinto decide on that. But look, if they exercise the option, that brings in another 18 million Australian dollars into the company. So we wouldn't be in a situation where we're, you know, even though the burn rate goes up with the pilot mining, is well within our capabilities.
And I suppose the option price is important, but there is no possibility they could buy 5% off the market at that price, even as we speak.
No, one of the issues, you know, dealing with the IR side of the business is we get a lot of inbounds. I'd like to buy a chunk of stock, but can't because the liquidity is not there or the sellers aren't there. We're in this kind of bittersweet moment where I don't think many people want to actually let go of their sovereign stock.
Yeah, but that normally ends up with a different result in the end.
Yeah.
Okay, so good luck with this production. I hope in time that we may be able to come and visit and see this, as we've discussed with you before. And we'll see how it all goes up. I noticed that an Australian company, if you go on to fattail.com, they have actually chosen you as one of the five stocks. Now, they don't actually say that in their information, but there's only one biggest retail deposit in the world and one second biggest graphite player in the world. So if you want to sit through a sales pitch for an hour, go for that, but it doesn't actually tell you very much about Sovereign. But what it does say is that people are buying that information to then look at your company and say, hey, this is one of the ones that could be, you know, a big player in the future.
Is it some sort of guessing game then going on? They just like guess the ticker?
Yeah, it's one of those sort of sales things that says it gives you basically an hour of why we're going into a super cycle of resource stocks. And it takes you back to 2002, where it talks about the Fortescue story and how that went from, you know, hero to zero, if you like.
Right.
So that's basically what we're talking about. And I think we're only at the very beginning of all this. We've got copper going up. We've got titanium going up. I'm sure the 25% on graphite in the US has basically put the graphite market prices up. It couldn't really have done much else, you know, in terms of globally, because now if you have a competitive advantage, if you're producing graphite from anywhere else but China, maybe that makes it more of a level playing field. I don't know. But yeah, we wish you luck. And hopefully we'll see you soon enough.
Yeah, look, so in terms of the pilot phase, we will be sharing across our social media and obviously RNSs over the coming weeks, you know, the progress that we make doing that. Hopefully we'll have some video clips and images of exactly what's happening on the ground, so people can feel, look and feel that, you know, this thing is real and this thing is actually moving ahead at quite a significant pace.
Very good. Well, thanks very much for coming on, Sapan. It's a pleasure as always.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Okay, so welcome Simon Rollison and Charles Bray from Aterian. We're just going to have a quick talk about copper in general and also some of the projects that you've got down there in good old Morocco, Simon. Tell us the main project that you're going to be starting to deal with and how drilling is going to begin, I think, in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, that's correct. So we've got the Agdes project, which is the, I would say it's the sort of the lead project for us at the moment. It's the one that's had the most work done onto it. On that particular asset, we've identified five sort of sub-prospects, if you like, on the project. So in July, we should be starting a scout drilling program. It'll be our first drilling on the project, and that'll be with reverse circulation. We're looking at 14 to 15 holes, 1,500 to 2,000 meters. And what we're going to do there is try and firm up the geological model that we've been putting together. So we'll be drilling in areas where we know there's some copper that's being reported from exploration trenching, from the mapping, from the sampling, and from some of the old historical workings that exist on the project. So they're going to be wide space, but I think it's going to be an exciting opportunity for us because we're finally going to get to see it in three dimension, and it will allow us to firm up on that model. And I'm pretty confident that we'll be intersecting some mineralization that will allow us then just to sort of think about the next phase, which will be more systematic drilling over some of these targets. You know, the work that we've done so far has probably outlined continuous strike extensions of mineralization for over sort of 5 to 6 kilometers on the different projects. So we'll start to get a much firmer view and just lift the whole confidence level of that particular asset.
So Simon, just give us an idea. What type of copper is this? Is this porphyry? Is it VMS style copper? Or what is it?
Well, what we're looking at is trying to get more data that will allow us to evaluate this properly, because we know nearby in that particular region of Morocco, historically, there have been identified a number of porphyry targets, and those occur off to the northeast of us. But, you know, what we look at on Agdes is a sort of structurally controlled environment where through these weaknesses in the rock caused by these fault zones, you've had intrusion of mafic granodiorite dikes, which host the mineralization. These come up along subvertical structures, is the interpretation from the data that we've had so far. But you also find the mineralization is disseminated out into a shallow dipping conglomerate bed. So we've got two potential target zones. We've got the sedimentary horizon that's sort of got the disseminated copper within it, and then these more confined subvertical feeder zones, if you like. And so what we're trying to do is just try to connect the dots and see how this fits into a genetic model. Is it related somehow to a porphyry at depth, or is it more just of a hydrothermal exposed occurrence?
Okay, and have we got any sort of percentages of copper from samples that have been done in the process here?
Yeah, we have. We've taken probably over 700 surface samples across the prospect. And I think the maximum value that was returned was about 26% copper. But we see a plethora of results that are above 1% copper. And if you took it down to, say, 0.3, given the copper price at the moment of like $10,000 a ton, you know, 0.3 probably becomes sort of economic. And yeah, we have abundance of copper. And this is the point of the drilling, really, is to see how we can cook these all together and how does it all tie as a model across the whole project area. But the nice thing also with Agdes is that we've got silver associated with the mineralization as well. So we've had up to 450 grams of silver out of one sample, but very common to find 30 to 40 grams per ton, which is a extremely impressive sort of byproduct to have. And what we've done is we've looked at the old historical data that was done over the last couple of years. And, you know, we do see sort of some elevation in gold values towards the southern part of the area that's been worked. Now, we've focused really on the top part of the license. The southern part of the license is where we started to see the gold coming in associated with the copper and the silver. So we're putting together a program to explore that southern part as well, to bring that all together.
So we're looking at copper, silver, gold, silver and gold kickers here, which obviously from the percentage, I mean, 26% copper. We saw a piece that when we were in Zambia for Shinganda, actually, the place there and held it, and it was, I think it was 35 to 40% copper, and it's just like a big chunk of metal, basically. So I presume 26 is pretty much the same type of thing. You know, you can almost see the copper in it, if you like, the mineralization. So this looks very exciting, and we look forward to some of the results. Just give us an idea, Charles, just about what's happened in Rwanda with the lithium, because I think we're in the process of starting to get Rio to start drilling there as well. So give the people an idea of what's happening and when we expect to hear something.
Yeah, that drill program is being finalized with Rio Tinto as we speak. The concern or issue is making sure that we just have everything in place. Rio Tinto has been incredibly professional and diligent with respect to all of the sampling and the preparatory work prior to the drill program. So we anticipate drilling to start the very end of Q2, beginning of Q3, and results should come relatively quickly from that. To the extent that we'll be announcing, I'd anticipate probably in September, sometime around then, about what we're finding at depth with respect to lithium and our view of a new lithium province in Africa.
So, Charles, just as a final thing, you recently raised some money. So just tell us how that money is going to be utilized. And, you know, obviously the stuff that's happening in Rwanda is pretty much 100% being covered by Rio Tinto. So how do you see this new financial input being used? Is it going to mainly be going into the ground in Morocco, or are we talking moving some of the other stuff in Botswana forward to give people an idea of what you think this money's going to be used for?
Our priority is always to spend the money on exploration activities. That being said, we will have to spend some of that on G&A. Just general corporate expense. However, the fundraising, which I'm very pleased to say was done at a premium, supported by existing shareholders, and that we raised, while we tried to raise enough to get the drill program done in Morocco, and we were successful in that extent, we didn't want to dilute too much given the significant number of catalysts we have coming up over the next quarter. So we tried to strike the balance right. We think we got that. We think we achieved that. And yeah, so very pleased to focus on getting this money spent on the ground in Morocco with our new drill program there on Agdas, which we're incredibly excited about given the copper price and generally the market's view on Morocco and copper.
Yeah. No, we're moving into a super cycle of resources, I'm sure, and you guys are well set, I think, with lithium, with copper, with, as Simon has said here, potential for silver and add-ons of gold. But I know you also have some actual gold assets also in Morocco there as well. So, yes, you have a good spread of what the world requires. And yeah, we look forward to hearing how that all plays out over the coming weeks and months.
All right, let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. So Golden Metal Resources, the gift that keeps on giving, I guess. It's expanded its 100% owned Garfield project in Nevada by staking 44 additional mineral claims, increasing the project area by over 3.68 square kilometers. Oliver Friesen highlighted the significance of securing a dense cluster of historical copper, gold, silver, and uranium data points, including old mine shafts and pits. Friesen's recent field visit confirmed extensive copper mineralization at the surface across the new and existing claims, particularly near buried magnetic targets identified earlier. The company is finalizing plans to explore for a buried copper porphyry at Garfield and will announce these steps soon. So, more work there done on these claims, these extra 44 mineral claims, increase the project area. What do you make of Golden Metals and the sort of news flow just seems so strong, doesn't it, and updates on all the projects?
Yeah, but the biggest update this week was the Department of Defense put out a slideshow showing what they were trying to do for their critical metals, and it openly showed Pilot Mountain as one of the projects that it was extremely likely to give a grant to. So that is now in the public domain. So I think you can safely say that it's sort of, what percentage can we say? 95 to 99% chance they're going to get some sort of grant, because why would you have it in a presentation when all of the ones in white in this presentation were getting, have already received their grants. The ones in yellow are scheduled for later this year. And it showed third quarter 2024 for Pilot Mountain. So there was a lot of that stuff floating around on the internet yesterday.
Yeah, I missed that, but I saw Charles.
That would be a game changer. Charles Archer put an article out on Thursday as well. So yeah, it all looks like things are really coming together. And you've got Pilot Mountain with now the potential for tungsten and an increase in that tungsten. It has silver, it has copper, it has garnet, and all of those things could increase by, you know, a factor of at least two and possibly more with this upcoming drilling campaign that's now started. And then we've got Garfield, which effectively now we've also found a porphyry. We've got high gold readings as well in terms of that, and a potential for a uranium play as well. And then subsequently, you've still got the gold, which hasn't really been investigated. And there also is lithium asset as well.
Yeah, the Kibi lithium basin as well. Yeah, so all of assets in it.
The share price still hasn't reacted. You know, you say it's the share that keeps on giving. But for all of that, we're worth, what, 14 or 15 million British pounds? I think if this was on the Canadian Stock Exchange or another stock exchange, it'd be four or five times what it's worth now, I think. That's my view on it. That goes back to the metals one thing as well. When you listen to that interview, you know, it's got a market cap of £3 million, and you've got the same company on the TSX with the similar assets, and it's got a market valuation of £92 million. So
yeah,
how is there a differential there of however many, a lot, you know, 30 times?
Yeah. Yeah, and, yeah, I get that. There's a big difference.
Is a similar scenario. Yeah, Oliver's running the show in a great way, and he's being helped by the geology as well. So it's all good.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so Mast Energy Developments as well. They had announced an update on the Pybridge site. There were some previous announcements in the previous week, but Pybridge received the second advance from Riverfort under the funding agreement. This allowed payments to the O&M contractor, Cooper Osland, for the full overhaul of the first genset. Replacement genset from Power Up in Austria is en route with preparatory site works on track. Timeline for completion and commercial operation for the refurbished genset remains on schedule, promising an earlier than expected increase in revenue. Meanwhile, the site's other two gensets continue operating, generating revenue through a PPA with Statkraft and receiving capacity market contract income from the government. And then on Thursday, there was also the announcement that the capitalization of a loan involving the issuance of 162,500,000 new shares to Director Peter Krugel at a conversion rate of 0.2 pence per share. So, news from Med. What do you make of MAST?
Yeah, it's sort of like an old man that's coming back to life, but it seems to be that, you know, it's off the life support machine now. And I think, you know, with this financial support and things being put in place, then it should become a legitimate investment again over the next period of time. And these were just two of the steps to make it that way, I think. So, yeah, certainly a long way to go still, but it's looking more favorable each time they produce something. You know, it's got income now. Didn't have income before, or didn't have income over the last period of time because it wasn't fulfilling its obligations. So, yeah, let's see where it goes. As we know, it's always had a lot of potential with all the different sites that it's got. Its biggest issue was it didn't have the cash. So if this allows them to have the cash to develop what they need to develop, then yeah, it could be extremely interesting play at this valuation, which is extremely low, like less than £1 million valuation for a main market company. I think I said on one of the groups that the main market listing's got to be worth more than the market cap right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, there's one. Benn's Creek obviously announced on Wednesday that they effectively resolved to file for administration following financial difficulties. Decision was made on the 21st of May, coming after receiving redemption notices from ACAM Limited and Avani for the repayment of approximately $7.57 million and $6.5 million in unsecured loan notes, respectively. Given the severe cash constraints, Benn's Creek is unable to meet obligations, leading to the consideration of administration or other insolvency processes. So, still remains suspended. And then on Thursday, they saw the news that WH Ireland, their broker, resigned. And this is the same WH Ireland who wrote the broker note at the back end of last year with a target of, I can't remember what the exact target was. It was many, many multiples of where the share price was at that time. So, sad news on that front, and obviously WH Ireland bowing out now.
Yeah, it's not good. Not happy about it. If you actually printed off one of the guides of the coal price, and really you just look at what happened with the metallurgical coal, and you know, there's your story. I think ultimately you can have a great asset, but just having a great asset, not having the market behind you in terms of what's going to be happening in the greater economic situation, then yeah, it could fail.
Yeah, I was going to say, how are the likes of Warrior Met Coal and Thungela and people like that coping with these? Do they require less of a profit margin in terms of, do they have a lower operating cost? I'm just trying to understand how it affects other miners who are in that similar met coal industry.
I think they just have longer contracts to supply the stuff. They probably have more continuity in terms of the trains, which was obviously an issue as well at Benn's Creek, and subsequently they have economies of scale, you know, so they're a much bigger operation, so therefore there's much more leeway, and also I think financially they will have huge amounts of debt within the company that allows them to survive through these periods, whereas Benn's Creek didn't have any of that. So, yeah, you know, if Benn's Creek had had a war chest of 20 million, that'd still be operating. It didn't, you know. And not only did it not, these guys were saying they wanted the money back now. So, you know, that, I mean, I can't say that was the final straw because I don't think it was. I think ultimately it was going down anyway from a few weeks ago. But yeah, it's very sad. I feel very sad having been there and understood the operation and spoke to the people who are actually working there. And yet, it's very sad for shareholders as well. So,
absolutely, these are the risks, aren't they? As you say, going into some of these things, it's, you know, we see the likes of quite a few companies. Horizonte was another casualty, wasn't it? So late, they appointed the administrators. So it does happen.
Yeah. And maybe it won't be the last either. But let's see. Because this week we've certainly had some serious movement in prices of copper and prices of gold and prices of silver. You know, as we spoke last week, the silver itself went up to 32. Copper was 10,700, 800 at one point. It settled down towards the end of the week. But, you know, we've been banging on about it now for a while, but we are moving into a super cycle of resources. So
yeah, you know, I'm actually reading a really good book at the moment. I brought it with me. Not exactly light reading, but it's called Inside Mining Capitalism, and it's the micropolitics of work on the Congolese and Zambian copper belts. And basically, it's put together by a few graduates, postgraduates. There's Christian Geenen, a research associate at the University of Liège. There's Emma Lockery. She's a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Liège too. Thomas McNamara is a lecturer in development studies at the University of La Trobe. And James Musonda, he received an MA degree in labor policy and globalization from the University of Witwatersrand in 2016. And basically, it's a collective book of research, and it's mainly aimed at talking about Zambian copper. But it goes through, talks about Kambove, the Democratic Republic of Congo. And then it starts off, it says, as you read these lines, you're probably using copper in one way or another. Do you know how it has been produced? The general aim of this book is to enhance our knowledge of the working conditions in which this metal is extracted in one of the world's major copper-producing regions, the Central African Copper Belt. And following the everyday life of mine workers, union leaders, and human resource managers, it seeks to shed some light on the hidden abode of production of one of the most basic commodities of the contemporary world. So it's a fascinating book. And it just goes into all the different mining operations and as I say, all like how they deal with HR and, you know, attitudes of people and a sort of foreign direct investment from the likes of the Chinese. But if anyone is you know, interested purely in a lot of Zambia comes up a lot in the Congo and how it works, and look out for the book to say Inside Mining Capitalism. It's a fascinating read.
Very good. You have to give me it once we've finished reading it and I'll read it.
Absolutely. Yeah, so the best mover of the week of all the stocks on the LSE was Powerhouse Energy. They were up some 91% on the week. And they had news of a resolution of a European patent challenge. Basically, they announced a claim originally issued on the 6th of October 2023 by GetGo Recycling Limited against its European patent, and patent applications have now been resolved. The agreement was reached to resolve the issues, and the company looks forward to progressing its other applications within Europe and the rest of the world. The agreement ensures that no additional challenge to Powerhouse's patents worldwide will be raised by Anunda or any of its group companies now or in the future. So I guess, you know, there was a lot of things, a lot of clouds hanging over the company based on that challenge. And Paul Emmett, the CEO, said this is a major step forward for Powerhouse and is pleased that this matter has been resolved. The whole process has been extremely time-consuming and a significant diversion for the team over the last 7 months. So it was around the 1.7 pence mark, but I mean, it dropped back in the week. It was down some 90% on that. So it was around trading around the 0.6, 0.7 pence mark or 0.8 pence, and it's moved back up into the sort of, you know, 1¾ pence. Yeah. Other news, Greatland Gold had a good announcement, Mount Egerton grant of exploration license. Exciting new gold copper exploration project established in the Gascoyne region, located 230 kilometres north of the Mikathara gold camp. Greatland have targeted the region as potentially having mantle tapping structures, an essential ingredient in large-scale gold and copper systems. The Woodlands tenement includes a 25-kilometre strike length in a structurally complex geological setting, which is potentially a very favourable mineralisation trap site. So yeah, good to see, you know, extra licences granted for exploration there.
Yeah, the other one that did very well this week, though it did drop back towards the end of the week, was Jubilee Metals. We saw it nearly touch 9p, and consider it was in the fives and sixes in the last few, literally, weeks, months. You know, it's a real play on the copper price and on the increase of production that we should see from them over the coming year from Zambia. And yeah, also the chrome is flying as well. So yeah, there's a lot to be interested in Jubilee Metals.
Cobra have had quite a good week as well, haven't they? They're up some 13%.
Yeah, rare earths in Australia. Again, if you want to do your research, we've done some presentations with Cobra. And, you know, I think that's one that's going to do extremely well over the next while. Going to compete with China in terms of the price of the rare earths. And it should be extremely interesting as it goes on. because it could be very, very profitable.
Yeah, there's Celadon had an RNS as well in the week. They moved, they punched back above the pound sort of 102 mark, and they announced a supply of cannabis-based products to a new US customer. So that was really, really welcomed. It's basically they signed an introductory sales contract with a long-established American business. It has successfully shipped two different medical cannabis products to the US, representing the company's first international commercial supply. The American business is a supplier to a number of different US government departments, and this initial sale has the potential to grow into a material source of additional revenue. Product has been supplied from the company's UK facility. So really good to see that supplying a product to the US customer.
Yeah, no, you can see that Celadon, as I said, I think last week, is it's not a supplier. That's not its main aim. But at the same time, it needs to do that initially to see how things are going to pan out. So yeah, very, very interesting what's going to be happening there over the next
day. Yeah, so we're talking about the some of the things we discussed last week. Usyk fight. I think we both said that he would technically win, which he did, and we got that one right. Football wise, obviously we saw City scoop their fourth consecutive Premiership title, which is I believe is a record. So fair play to City for doing that. Pulling out, it was a very, very well sort of quite close run thing at the end. Although Arsenal won in the end, but wasn't obviously quite enough for the points department. But fair play to City. Anything else been happening in the sports department? Or
but did
like
you
that?
Did you see that Sky Sports featured Klopp going more than the Manchester City game?
Yes,
you know Manchester City winning the championship played second fiddle to Klopp. The Klopp farewell, which you know.
I can't say I'm surprised, though, really, to be honest.
Some way, that's really quite amazing, you know? The Champions Elect was not as interesting as
I think people, there's a bit of apathy there, you know? Four wins in a row, it's almost become a sort of, not a foregone conclusion, but if I ask you now, read your favourite team off for next season, you'd probably say City.
Yeah, I wouldn't probably, for sure.
Exactly.
The scenario has got to be, though, that these 115 different things that they supposedly have done has to be answered. Next season, it has to come out, right?
That's a really interesting one.
Are they guilty or are they not guilty?
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of been swept under the carpet. When I think it's going to happen next year, isn't it, this inquiry? But, I mean, like, why is it taking so long? Surely something so significant for a team that have dominated the Premiership for the last 4 to 5 seasons, and even longer than that, because, that's just consecutive wins. Why isn't there been an investigation? If there has been some wrongdoing, then surely they're going to be stripped of these titles.
Definitely, but we will see. I mean, Klopp's team scored in excess of, I think, 97 points three separate occasions. Won the league only once. In history, nobody's ever scored this many points and not won the league. So, you know, that doesn't undermine Manchester City unless they were spending a lot more money than they should have been spending. And we don't know for sure whether they were or they weren't. But the scenario is it needs to be sorted out that they're either not guilty or there needs to be some payback, just like Everton had to pay back, just like Boris.
Well, exactly. I mean, we've seen it. Portsmouth got absolutely smashed down, and they got promoted again of late. I mean, you know, there's been so many teams. Leeds, it happened to, you know, there's so many teams that have actually had a real punishment. Whereas it almost feels like City have become untouchable.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure there'll be a few people screaming at the podcast right now, but we will see.
I'm not pushing for it. At the end of the day, it's got to be a fair trial, and everything has to be considered. I'm not pushing for them. It's not a soreness and saying, well, they should be, you know, they shouldn't be, they should have titles rescinded. I'm saying if there has been any wrongdoing, I'm sure that you know, they'll see fit and they'll issue that any fines or punishments that are deemed satisfactory. But it just seems bizarre that one minute there's talk of it happening and that, you know, it was all over the media, and then all of a sudden it swept under the carpet, forgotten about. And then now we're only just starting to hear a few little snippets in papers saying, yeah, there's going to be an inquiry and all these things are going to happen. But yeah, it's just bizarre that it goes from being shouted from the rooftops to you hear nothing about it.
Yeah, and now we build up to the Euros. So yeah, can England win the European Championships? That is the question.
We've seen them get so far so many times in the last, you know, the World Cup was good. They played well. We've seen a better team get in the Euros. I mean, I was at the semi-final at Wembley. We got through to the finals against Italy. We always become the sort of the also-rans, don't we? Do you know what I mean? We, we, we're the nearly men, aren't we? We get so far, but then we fall at the last, whether it be to penalties against the Italian. You know what I mean? There's always like a drama at the last minute. Will we ever see England men ever win, like the women won the tournament, we saw the Euros. Will English men's team ever win a significant tournament in our lifetimes? Answers on a postcard.
I say yes, and I think this is as good a chance as we're going to have in the next while. When you look at the talent that's there with Foden, Saka,
Grealish.
Yeah, I'm not even sure Grealish is going to make it, because he didn't pick the United guy, did he? Didn't pick Rashford. He's not taking Rashford at all. But there is abundance of talent. You've got the experience of Harry Kane. You know, whether you like it or not, he's been probably one of the top scorers in Europe this season. So, yeah, who knows? Who knows? But let's hope that they put on a good show and see whether we can bring it.
Yeah, because it lifts morale, doesn't it, when you're in the UK? You know, you're in England, and the summers are amazing when there's a buzz about the team. You know, I remember 2-3 years ago when we were going through those the Euros in the UK, and as I say, at the Wembley, the buzz and everything was phenomenal when we got through to the final. But as I say, we need something to cheer about, that's for sure. All right, well, I think we've talked long enough. It's been an action-packed show this week. Hope you've enjoyed the chat that we've had with the CEOs and CCOs. And please hit the subscribe button and the bell icon for future notifications, any future episodes.
Indeed. Thanks for listening, guys.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.